I'm Steve, as Kate mentioned. It's great to be with you today. This chilly day, so we got a snowfall coming tonight. I'm excited about that. My kids were rooting for like a foot of snow. I think that's not in the cards, but we can always hope. Welcome back to our second week of our Light in the Darkness season. It's what we're calling our Christmas time here at Reservoir. If you were around last week, we took a break from storytelling from the stage, and we had a participatory service, a liturgy of lament and hope, and it was beautiful, and I'll have more to say about that in a little bit. Next week, we'll be back with a follow-up talk here at 11:30. The two Sundays after that, Christmas Sunday, New Year's Sunday, we'll be here with just one service at 10:30. For those of you that are in town, like to be with us on Christmas Day or New Year's Day, just a 10:30 service each of those weeks. And then on Christmas Eve, we have our annual service of storytelling and song and candlelighting, kind of a traditional Christmas Eve service, a beautiful 7:30. It ends before 8:30. And we'll have a 7 to 7:30, like refreshments and crafts and stuff out in the lobby for folks who are early. So we'd invite you to that as well on Christmas Eve. I'm going to pray for us and then share some things I've been thinking about this Christmas season. Thanks, God, for everything, for cold weather, for snowy evenings, for days where things get canceled and days where they don't, for the beauty of this candlelight. For all the things this season calls to mind for each of us, probably a wild mix of good and bad and somewhere in between. Thanks that this is life and that we can find you in all of it. We pray that we would today and that you'd be good to us and speaking encouragement to us wherever we are this Christmas season. Amen. So it's been a bit of a busy fall, and Christmas has snuck up on me a little bit this year, but it is 2 weeks away, I realize, and it's starting to pop up all around us, including some surprising places, including last week on Saturday Night Live. I didn't catch last night's yet, but last week's had some interesting and fun Christmas stuff, and I got a kick out of one of the sketches in particular that I thought would take us well into today's talk. It's SNL's take, at least for last week, on a Mary, Jesus, and Joseph moment. So we're going to watch that first. Here it is. Saturday Night Live has, of course, added all the self-consciousness and the judgy parts to the story. But part of the humor they're working is just teasing out what's right there in the original Christmas story, which what seems like the utter incongruity of a human being sent by God as light into the world, being born in a barn amidst filth and straw. This king of the Jews become the leader of all humanity, born to a peasant teenage girl in a backwater small town in Palestine. It really does border on the ridiculous. And I ask myself, why would God do such a thing? Well, I think that God knew something about the world that Jesus is entering into. I think God looked the collective human experience straight in the eyes, so to speak, and chose quite consciously to enter into our story as this dirty Christmas baby. The October edition of The Atlantic had this piece by Roger Rosenblatt called "The World's a Thriving Slaughterhouse." And in this article, he describes sifting through this whole attic's worth of mementos of his career as a journalist in refugee camps and in war zones. And he calls to mind memories of suffering and of terror alongside stories of cannibalism and war and mass graves. And right alongside these stories, he remembers victims, players in these events, telling him that despite or alongside all that slaughter, they still see light and beauty, at least sometimes. It's this really hopeful and at the same time brutal work of journalism that says to those of us in comfort and in privilege, like, this is the world we live in, this thriving slaughterhouse. Jesus, as we'll see today, wasn't born sort of apart or separate or above all of this. He wasn't raised in a luxury of a palace or in a modern, beautiful, heated home. He wasn't born in a hospital or a Mary center, much at least to this version of a birthing center, much to this Mary's chagrin. He was a peasant child. He was a refugee. And before that, he was simply this dirty baby born in a barn. One who'd eventually deliver us all, we're told, from our suffering and our violence and our sin, but one who first experiences all that firsthand himself, who unites the life of God with the whole of human misery. I'm going to read the second half today of the Christmas story from the perspective of the good news of Matthew. Here it is. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, "Where is this Messiah supposed to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote, 'And you, O Bethlehem in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be shepherd for my people Israel.'" And then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too." If we think lying politicians or power-hungry leaders are a new thing, we have not read the Bible very much or learned very much from history. It's an old story, but these stargazers are not so naive, we'll see. It says, "After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the palace where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And when it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. After the wise men were gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. 'Get up, flee to Egypt with the child and his mother,' the angel said. 'Stay there until I tell you to return, because Herod is going to search for the child to kill him.' That night, Joseph left for Egypt with the child and Mary, his mother, and they stayed there until Herod's death. This fulfilled what the Lord had spoken through the prophet, 'I called my son out of Egypt.' Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. He sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, based on the wise men's report of the star's first appearance. Herod's brutal action fulfilled what God had spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A cry was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeps for her children, refusing to be comforted, for they are dead." Merry Christmas, by the way. It's like a hard ending to the Christmas story. I speak about this text pretty much every year. One, there are very little material to work with. There are pretty much two Christmas stories in the Bible's account, so you sort of keep coming back to the same ones. But also, this story really continues to speak to me quite vividly, that the original Christmas story is about this refugee family fleeing state power from one country to another, trying to escape this paranoid bully politician. It's about this dirty Christmas baby born into filth, narrowly escaping his own slaughter. Christmas starts here by recognizing that if you are not in these kinds of situations, you're at first at least an outsider to the story. I read a book by a gentleman, Howard Thurman, called Jesus and the Disinherited this week. Howard Thurman was like a significant pastor and philosopher and kind of public figure in the early 20th century. He was a dean of chapel at Howard University. And then after a while, he came back and did that work at Boston University here in our city as well. He was able to mentor Martin Luther King Jr., amongst other people who were there at BU in the 40s and 50s, a center named after him there. And Howard Thurman, in this book, Jesus and the Disinherited, he starts by noticing that most of Christian theology over the centuries and church history has been written by people of great privilege, people who are involved with the Roman Empire, thinkers and leaders in state-backed churches that supported monarchies, white and relatively affluent Europeans and Americans in modern times. But Jesus, he says, he notices, was not born into these settings. Jesus was not born into the life of those that inherit power, the life of the privileged. Jesus was born to the disinherited, to the powerless, the vulnerable, what Thurman just calls simply people who have their back up against the wall. And he says, if we don't get this, then we are outsiders to the story, no matter how much we read it, no matter how much we might retell it or kind of co-opt it for our own purposes. I find it interesting, though, because even in a congregation of relative comfort and relative privilege as we are, suffering still has a way of kind of sneaking up and getting to us. We saw vividly last week that we still, in many ways, do get this aspect of the story. If you look to your left and right, the purple and yellow sticky notes that cover these two walls are mementos from last week's service. They represent some of the lamentations and hopes of the people of Reservoir. So in last week's service, we were invited in groups to take purple sticky notes and to write on them our laments, which is a word that kind of captures disappointments, complaints, losses, or frustrations that anger and sadden us. And we also, beside those, named our hopes, put them on yellow sticky notes, our desires, our prayers, our longings for God to do various things in our private worlds or out in the public world. And a couple of times during this past week, I walked around this sanctuary by myself, just reading these laments and reading these hopes and praying for them. And it was both a beautiful and a heartbreaking experience. I'd walk along praying, I'd see in front of my foot a purple sticky note on the ground with just all capital letters spelling out the word cancer. Or another note that I saw, actually several of these had this theme, like so-and-so still isn't getting better. Or other notes that had things like a phrase that simply just said, total failure. Like, whoa, it's arresting, right? And then to join you in praying for your hopes, kind of pray through everything in these yellow notes, praying for a lot of longings for family members to get well, praying quite a few notes for friends and people in your life to find partners, find mates, a lot of prayers for just all kinds of very specific things to turn around for the better. We're leaving these up, by the way, this week and next, a kind of installation for this season. You can add to them if you like this week or next week. There are purple and yellow sticky notes and baskets on the heaters there. And at any point after I talk, during the music, or before or after service, we'd welcome you if you like to, if you weren't here, or even if you were, to jot down your own laments, your own sort of losses, frustrations, things you'd like to get off your chest onto a purple note and just put it up on either wall, or any hope that you have as well to jot that on a yellow note, put them up on the wall. We also lit candles last week. It's a pretty old traditional way of symbolizing prayer. So to light a candle as part of representing that you're offering these up to God in prayer to hear and to act upon. So you'll have the opportunity to do that later if you'd like. This is a way for us to celebrate this light in the darkness season this year and to keep it reality-based, to ground our celebration of Christmas right in our world of loss and yearning that we long to see Jesus in. This is our reality in which we wait for our salvation, our help. And this is just, it's the messy world we know, steeped in both hope and in suffering, that Jesus was born into as this dirty Christmas baby. And the passage we read today, this particular chapter of Matthew has like complicated historical questions attached to it. We don't know exactly how these things happened. Matthew's the only ancient source that says Jesus and his family fled out of Egypt. Matthew's also the only ancient source that describes this massacre of King Herod against these little babies in Bethlehem. None of the other gospels in the Bible tell these stories, and there isn't any other ancient historical source that kind of verifies these accounts. It doesn't mean that they're not true. There's all kinds of external evidence that Herod was this really brutal and violent, tyrannical king. Also, small towns in this age were really small, so there wouldn't have been that many male babies under two in a village like Bethlehem. And so a slaughter of children, unfortunately, this period of time, sort of wouldn't have made the pages of history. All to say, as history, we hold this chapter just kind of humbly or kind of lightly, not knowing exactly the details of what happened 2016, 2017, 2018 years ago. As theology, though, as sort of Matthew making meaning out of how to understand the Jesus experience, this chapter is quite clear, at least to Matthew's original Jesus Jewish audience. On the one hand, Jesus is living so that other people can be saved. This flight into Egypt that this family makes, it's a reenactment of the whole story of the Jewish people. So Jacob, who is a patriarch of the Jewish people, also the first person named Israel, His whole family fled into Egypt, one of them in slavery and the others driven there by famine. And then in the great event that generations later is like the genesis of the people of Israel, Jacob's descendants leave Egypt in this great exodus. God delivers them from slavery and from oppression and from death. And Matthew says Jesus is doing this again, but this time it's for all people. Jesus' life is spared so that he can come back out of Egypt and deliver us, so that we can come out of our slavery and our Egypts, so that the oppressed everywhere can be saved from their enslavement, so that even oppressors can be saved from their own diminishment. But then there's this twist in this usual formula about Jesus, that Matthew tells us too, that not just Jesus living so that all people could be delivered, but others die in this story so that Jesus could live. It's a strange thing in this story. For centuries, Jesus' followers have said the reverse, that Jesus died so we could live. It's this ancient creedal formula. It captures a really significant aspect of the meaning of the life of Jesus in just a few words. Jesus died so that we could live. It's powerful. It's true. It's at the heart of this faith tradition. It's part of that out of Egypt story for each of us. But in the Christmas story, Matthew tells us the reverse also occurred. Other people died, these babies in Bethlehem, so that Jesus could live. I think in this part of the narrative, in this little twist Matthew gives us, Matthew really validates suffering. Matthew speaks the truth that not all of life is subject to immediate rescue and immediate deliverance. Not all bad situations see turnarounds, even when we pray about them and lift them up to God. I think this is super validating of our reality. All these yellow sticky notes around the room, for instance, all these hopes. Some of your pastors, including myself, when we take these down before Christmas Eve, we're going to put them somewhere private and just pray over them throughout the whole next year, off and on, pulling out these hopes of the Reservoir community, asking God to fulfill them. And some of them are going to be accomplished. Some of them are going to be accomplished in kind of mundane ways that you barely notice. You're going to look back next Christmas and remember, oh yeah, that hope I put up in the wall, like it has come to pass. That's an exciting thing. I have quite high expectation that some of these hopes on the walls are going to be enacted in kind of what looks like miraculous ways, like sort of stunning and surprising turn of circumstances, and that you'll think, wow, like God did that thing that I was longing for, and it'll be very exciting. These will be tremendous stories. We're going to love these stories of rescue, as we should. But, sorry to be a downer, some of these sticky notes of hope are simply going to remain sticky notes. They're going to be prayed for many times, and the words will fade on the note as people lift them up and the oils of our hands kind of decay the note, and a year will go by and nothing will have changed. It'll just be a note there. And I think this is just the Christmas reality we live in. It's not fantasy or wishful thinking. That Jesus sometimes comes to us by delivering us from suffering, and sometimes Jesus comes to us by sitting there with us, and the suffering seems to sit right next to Jesus, and we don't see anything happening yet. This is something I think about a lot in my more trying circumstances, something I think a lot. I actually talk to my children a lot in parenting my kids through like an unfair and difficult world, that reality is like this immovable force. If we can't stand our lives and our circumstances or our world sometimes, like fair enough, sometimes reality shouldn't be stood. It's like not always a happy thing. Sometimes all our circumstances deserve our annoyance or our frustration, but then they're still there. Reality is like this immovable force that can crush us and it can embitter our spirit when it doesn't go our way. We can, on the other hand though, we can greet reality as it is. Not our friend or our enemy really, just there. And we can know that this reality is the space that God lives. And we can notice all the resources we have to face that reality and find gratitude in them. And reality, too, is the place where we can ask for the help and the hope that we need God to thrive in it and to face it well. Howard Thurman, the scholar, pastor I was talking about, he calls this space and this attitude what happens there? He says that's the most important deliverance Jesus offers. That Jesus offers freedom from fear and hate and bitterness, and freedom to have love and courage and hope. He writes in this famous book, he says, Jesus' message focused on the urgency of a radical change in the inner attitude of the people. He recognized fully that out of the heart are the great issues of life, and that no external force, however great or overwhelming, can at long last destroy a people if it does not first win the victory of the spirit against them. To revile because one has been reviled, that is the real evil, because it's the evil of the soul itself. Jesus saw this with almighty clarity. Again and again, he came back to the inner life of the individual. With increasing insight and startling accuracy, he placed his finger on the inward center as the crucial arena where the issues would determine the destiny of the people. Thurman sees this like inner world and what happens there as this, when it was like most significant battle of our lives. I think publicly, most significant battle of our Christmas season 2016. Like what becomes of our inner landscapes? To have hope in those spaces, it's like a muscle. It takes practice. We have to practice seeing our circumstances with God in them. Talking to Jesus, like he's not far away waiting to just rescue us out of our circumstances, but he's right there in them as well. We can do that, I think, because of Christmas. The meaning of the incarnation, sort of a theological world for what Christmas means from a spiritual perspective. God taking on flesh. The meaning to this is that God is uniting, Jesus is uniting God with humanity. Now, prior to the birth of Jesus, the human story is one that God set in motion or created that was important to God for sure, but was still external to the life of God. But with Jesus, both from now and then forever, the idea is that the human experience is part of God's lived experience. Our story is also God's story. Jesus is a dirty baby, born vulnerable to the possibility of all kinds of immense suffering so that God can be with us even there. This is also part of what I think affects our eventual deliverance, that God can lead us out of suffering because God knows the way through it. But God can also be with us in our suffering because it's part of the life of God now as well. God is one with us in all those spaces. I want to share with you a picture of, I think, how this can work. It's actually from last week's This American Life. They did a episode to their hour called Once More with Feeling. There's about three sets of people that really believe in course correction, believe that you can kind of get a do-over on something and have it change. And the central story to this was from a vet by the name of Michael Petrie. And Petrie is a veteran of our long war in Iraq, and he's this great storyteller. He's always a vivid storyteller, a funny guy. And he realized after he got back from his last tour in Iraq, people would ask him to tell war stories because, you know, they knew this was true, and they figured he'd have some great stories. And he did. He had some great stories, and he'd tell them, but he realized they weren't the stories people wanted to hear. They were way too dark. Like, people died in his stories, because wouldn't you know, there were war stories, like stuff like that happens. But people would have a really hard time with the stories. And he faced this dilemma that, you know, he says a lot of vets face, that if you don't talk about your experiences, I suppose actually a lot of trauma victims of all kinds of things face. If you don't talk about your experience, people think, like, what's wrong with you? Like, you must need a lot more therapy. Like, you're just a damaged goods. You can't even talk about what happened. But then when you do talk about your experiences, like, no one wants to hear. They're like, actually, let's not talk about those things. He said, how do you find your way through this? He said, well, his strategy was he'd tell decoy stories. Like, people would ask him for a story, and he'd think of his true story, and then he would think of another true story that was funny and kind of related to the real story he'd want to tell, but no one would want to hear. So, for instance, people would ask him now and then, like, you were in the desert where there's scorpions there. And the first story that would come to mind, the true story about scorpions, was this, like, awful moral dilemma that he and his soldiers are always forcing upon people, which was that scorpions were actually like a real danger in the desert, and people would sleep on the rooftop of their houses because it was too hot to sleep inside, and sometimes children would be bitten at night by scorpions. But there were curfews in many cities in Iraq for, you know, understandable reasons. They were enforced at the time while he was there by American soldiers. So he said, what would happen is that people would come to him and say, if my child is stung by a scorpion in the night, should I break curfew to go to the, you know, American medical base or not? And he said, every time they'd say, oh, you should come and save your child. We'll take good care of you. But he said he and his troops would think, actually, if you come out in the middle of the night, you're taking your whole family's life into your hands because you're breaking curfew and I can't promise you anything. So this is just like an awful, awful choice that was forced upon families. But he would sort of stop himself. He started telling a story and he's like, wait, that's a bad story. It's like, no one wants to hear that story. It's really depressing. And so instead, he'd be like, oh, I have another scorpion story to tell you. And he'd tell people about the time that, like, his soldiers caught this scorpion and named it Fred. And they really liked having a pet scorpion because scorpions are kind of cool. You can make them fight each other and see which scorpion wins. And this is, like, a really good fighting scorpion. It would always win the fights. And his soldiers were in love with Fred the scorpion. And he found out how dangerous a scorpion was, so they had to kill the scorpion because it was too dangerous. But they loved the scorpion. They wanted to kill him gently, not smash him or anything. They wanted to euthanize him. And so they put him in a bucket of oil for 3 days. They figured, oh, they put him out of his misery, like, peacefully. At the end of 3 days, they tipped the bucket of oil over, and, like, after 2 seconds, Fred sort of shook the oil off and, like, scampered off into the desert. So he would tell the story of, like, Fred, the, you know, oil-surviving scorpion, like, over and over. People would love it. He'd get laughs. He was welcome at parties. So the problem was that over time, like, the truth would leak out under these decoy stories. Like, eventually he'd find himself in a situation, ask for a story, and he would explode. He was violent sometimes in unpredictable circumstances. Because the truth had been suppressed so long, it would leak out with all kinds of force. And so his decoy stories, you know, they weren't actually bringing him closer to other people. They were keeping other people at a distance, and they were keeping him, in a way, at a distance from himself, alienated from his own experience, pushing them away. So his friends, especially his wife, were really worried about him, worried about this outburst that they'd see now and then. Told him he had to talk to someone. When he talked to someone, he realized he had to find a way to tell his true stories. And so one time with his best friend, who had asked him for a lot of these stories about scorpions and funny things, his friend said, can you tell me a story about, like, how, you know, you guys are brave. They say you'll never leave someone behind in the battlefield, even if they're injured or killed. You know, you always take care. And he said, you know, a true story came to mind. He said, that is true. And his friend said, how does this battlefield, you know, recovery work? He said, well, how it works is that you go out and you find your buddy who's been killed and you station a soldier with a gun to shoot the dogs as the dogs try and eat your buddy while you collect his parts and to bring him home. And he said, that's how it works, okay? And what happened when he told his friend this story is he just starts, like, crying because he hasn't told this story to anyone before. And he said, I knew it was going to be okay because my friend looked me in the eye. The interviewer said, like, why did that tell you it's going to be okay? What did that mean to you? He says, well, when you see a monster, you always turn away. He said, but my friend looked me in the eye. I knew I wasn't a monster. Like, there was room for my stories in the world. And, like, that's the path toward kind of Michael's, you know, embracing of experience, his healing from it. He still tells these decoy stories all the time, right? He's like, there's situations where I just need the funny story. But now he doesn't only tell these stories as well. He asks himself, it's like this kind of line he picked up from military strategy, asks himself, like, what do I know, who needs to know, and have I told them? And then he decides what story to tell. And I thought about this story and that phrase at the end, and I thought, you know, what do we know, and who needs to know, and who do we need to tell? Well, amongst whatever stories we choose to tell to anyone in our life, we've all got good stories and bad stories. We've got all the stories on the walls right now. We have our laments and our hopes about our private worlds, about the public world. And I think God says, I need to know these stories. I need to be in these stories. And God looks us in the eye, never seeing a monster, but seeing a kid of God's that God loves, and says, tell me your stories. Talk to me. Name whatever darkness you're aware of and see what light I can't bring into it as you tell that story. This past week, I was remembering a story that I hadn't thought about in a while. I've not told this story very often, but when you have a life working for a dad who does construction in people's home and then kind of a life in kind of human service, you meet interesting people and encounter interesting situations now and then. And I was thinking about a time when I was visiting the home of an elderly person that no one had heard of in a while and trying to see if this person was okay or if they're still alive. And I knocked on the door and no one answered. And so I went into the house to look for this gentleman, and the door was open. And I came across like the biggest situation of hoarding that I had ever seen. I heard this dynamic of people hoarding things and creating difficulties themselves. And I looked upon this house with just like a thin passageway to walk through and no space to even travel around, let alone to live in or sleep in. And I felt like only compassion for the person who lived there. I thought, oh, what a painful thing to be experiencing all alone, for it must have been, you know, years, who knows how long this had built up. And what a painful situation to live in. And I was really afraid I was going to find this gentleman like lying dead amongst the hoard. And I came across this like pile of blankets in the kitchen where it looked like he was sleeping, because it must have been the warmest room in an otherwise cold house. And I remember seeing the blankets and praying like to myself, like, oh God, like I hope I don't find a person here. And I didn't. There was no one there. And it turns out that he'd been in a hospital and, you know, was taking care of, things were moving along. But I recall that story this weekend. And kind of out of nowhere, I felt Jesus talking to me. I felt like Jesus said to me, Steve, you didn't see me, but I was the one under the blanket. I thought, because I remember seeing those blankets, being sure there was a person there. And then I lift him up, there's no one there. Like Jesus was like, Steve, I was there under the blankets. I was in this house all along. I was right in the middle of that pain and suffering. And then after, I was just like stunned by that little moment of prayer. After I thought about that, situation after situation, including some fresh ones from this week, where I was just in touch with, you know, kind of pain and darkness in someone's world, I felt like Jesus was giving me almost like this little film of like all the spaces that Jesus was in these different lives and different households and different situations. And Jesus was speaking to me. There's nowhere you can't find me, Steve. Like even in the chapters of your story, the chapters of other people's stories, that it really looked like God wasn't there. There is nowhere that I am not. Like it's really true that in the incarnation, in the birth of Jesus, the whole human story has been brought into unity with the life of God. God has connected with the entire human story, including every part of suffering. This gives me profound hope. As I ask Jesus to do his thing of light and hope and in my life, as I ask Jesus to do it in all these circumstances you see represented by all these laments and hopes, which are kind of our own collective yearnings and groans in the room, I think I want more of this Christmas season. I want to find Jesus in more and more places and realize he's there right in our suffering, there to be there with us and there in time to transform it and to deliver us from it. And I want to close today with like three kind of specific thoughts on things that are helping me move toward that experience that might help you as well. You can jot them down if you like, but here they are. My first invitation to you in light of this talk today is to listen to and tell truer stories. To listen to and tell truer stories. Right, just as Michael Petry learned, like in telling his decoy stories, the kind of fake version of his actual thoughts and experiences, he becomes out of touch with his own life, unable to connect with the most important things in life, unable to connect with others. You realize he needs spaces to tell true stories. That was really the main purpose of last week's service, if you were here, is to kind of unlock in this season this collective need that we felt that we all have in the season to name our true stories, to say, yeah, there's things I'm not happy about in my life and in the world, and there's things I long for that are not true yet in my life and in the world. And I think we got to find space to tell those stories, to listen to those stories. Kind of related point, it's really like another way of saying the same thing, is the second idea, which is to make and listen to lament. Again, this is just like a spiritual kind of traditional word to say, to listen to and to say yourselves, to give voice to whatever frustrations, loss, sadness, difficulty you experience, and to do that spiritually, which is really just saying, say those things to God. I felt for whatever reason an important theme for the Christmas season this year. It's not one that we made up at Reservoir. It's not particularly novel. The old prayer book of the Bible, this book of Psalms, 150 poems, has been like the prayer book of Jews and Christians for millennia. They've been the written prayers that have taught people how to pray for millennia. Over a third of these psalms are psalms of lament. They begin with sadness and anger and frustration. For the first third to a half, they just give voice to that. And then they remember what God is like and things God's done in some other time and say, God, could you get busy, get to work now. and they end in that spirit. Over a third of these. And I think, what does that say about prayer? What does it say about the human experience? What does it say about spirituality? Well, I think it says this is a big part of it, to give voice to difficulty and frustration and to name those true stories in front of other people who are willing to hear and in front of God, and to invite God, to beg God, to, the Psalms actually sort of command God to act and show God is real right in the middle of that. I think that's the invitation we have in the season. That's why we're leaving this installation up, inviting you to continue to participate, that we can name and lift these things up to God. Thirdly, the invitation is to go in and out of Egypt. This is like a metaphor. I don't know much about Egypt this time of year, if you want to travel there or not. Go for it if you do. Tell us all what it's like. But in at least a metaphorical sense, to go in and out of Egypt, much as Jesus did. Which I mean by that, to expect and to accept and to enjoy deliverance in every form. It's interesting to me that in this original Christmas story, that life as a refugee is how Mary and Joseph and Jesus first experience deliverance. And I tend to think of life as a refugee as like a real tragic thing, as a really hard thing, which I guess it is, right? To be fleeing into a country where you don't speak the language, and you aren't necessarily welcome, and you're fleeing tragedy and trauma. Like, that sounds like a really hard thing. For Jesus, Mary, and Joseph to be refugees in Egypt was like the form of their deliverance, right? As it is for all refugees, right? It's better than where they were. I think, wow, like if that's what we've got, enjoy that deliverance. One of our board members this week was reflecting at the end of a board meeting about this experience last week and said, you know what was the most interesting thing to me about it? Is there's been this thing that any other year I would have named as a lament. Like it's this thing in my life that's really frustrated me. And this person was like, this year, that didn't come up. It's not a lament. I sort of feel okay about it. And they were saying, I think I need to pay attention to that. Like God shifted something in me that I'm at peace with something that I've never been at peace with before. Like that's its own kind of deliverance to enjoy as well. This has obviously been like a slightly on the darker side of Christmas sermons than you usually get this time of year. I think we have something brighter and cheerier coming your way next week on Christmas Eve and all that. But I do want to say, like, if you're having the most awesome Christmas season ever, like your life and circumstance are sort of full of joy and light, we want to celebrate that too. Like if all of life feels like a story of deliverance, like, wow, God and even the whole universe, like doing good to me, it appears. And I just want to celebrate that. That's another great thing to do in the season. But even if that's not your story, even if you feel like, oh, I'm looking for deliverance, like I'm in a hard situation that I'm waiting for God to act in. Well, I think in some ways that's the very best place to be to experience God, because God comes first in that into that space. The Christmas story begins with Jesus. This is, you know, whatever, we saw it in a jokey way, but this dirty baby in like a filthy barn there to begin uniting the whole human experience with the very life and heart of God. That's where we're most likely to find Jesus. And I trust and hope that we will be doing that as we tell our stories this year. I'm going to ask you to stand in a minute. You can hold off, but we're going to have a chance to try and connect with God in those ways for the rest of service. And our goal or our hope is to let you, and we'll give you multiple ways to do this, kind of tell your true story to yourself and God and see how God can connect with you in that space. So right here, while you have a little time set aside to do that, and while you have some people around here that are trying to do the same thing. Some different ways you can do that. One is if you'd like a partner in this, you'd love for someone to pray for you, we'll have space for you to do that. So we have, as we do every week, people that'll be in the back right standing there with a lanyards on, identify them as a member of our prayer team, and they would love to pray for you for anything on your mind. They also like to kind of prime the pump a little and see if there's anything in particular that might resonate with people in the room that they would love to pray for you for. These may be things that sort of God is hoping or expecting to today. To do today. And when they were praying this morning, there were three things that came to mind. They had jaw pain come to mind. It's actually come up like a lot this fall, I'm noticing. So if you have jaw pain, like they feel like they really would love to pray for you and see what God can do in that for you. If you have discomfort or injury in your eyes, particular problems with their vision lately, they would love for you to experience God's healing in that as well. And the last thing that came to mind for them, sort of lament or hope, would be around marriage or family conflict. And particularly if people in marriage or family are experiencing the threat of separation, they feel like God would have a gift for you today and they would love to pray for you. The other thing you can do again, beyond getting prayer, is that you can participate in her walls of lament and hope. So you can grab sticky notes from either side and write down, give voice to difficulty, disappointment, purple, or hope, yellow. Simply put that up on the wall. It's a symbol of saying, I don't want to carry that all by myself. I'm going to share that with my community, however it is you end up later doing that. And a symbol of saying, I'd like to lift that up to God as well. And if you want, you can light a candle. There's candles on those two tables. It's a symbol of the spirit of prayer in which you're offering that to God as well. And we'll be singing too with the hope that God will be here in the space and connect with us wherever we are today. Could you stand for a sec if you're able? Let me pray for us and our band will kick off the rest of the time. God, I'm really grateful that the stuff we're talking about today, that this is how you entered our world as a human. It's, you know, it's obviously not how any of us would have done it. It's not intuitive that you would choose a rural outpost, a barn, a set of nobodies in which to enter the human story yourself. I'm just grateful, though, that this is how you did it and that this is how you do it, God. I'm grateful that you've united everything in the human experience into your heart, that you know us in that firsthand kind of way. I'm grateful that each experience of each person in the room is a ready space for you to be with us, that there is nowhere, Jesus, that you can't be today. So we pray that we would taste and see that we'd experience you, Jesus, as close to us, as with us, as present with us, ready to be close and ready to act in every situation. Amen.